Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. We're now on series four of the show, and as you may already be aware, we're on a mission to help clinical researchers from around the world with tips, tricks, and inspiration. So if you could do me a quick favor and please hit that follow or subscribe button, it really does help more than you'll ever know. Once again, Adam Walker is alongside me, so sit back, relax, and we'll take things from here. This week, Adam and I are joined by Rob King at FHI Clinical. Rob, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, because I think I mentioned when reaching out, I've had a few people actually that have wanted to know a bit more about FHI Clinical and the work that you're doing. So look, if you could give the audience a quick overview of, I guess, you, your role, and what the company is doing, that would be incredible to kick us off.
Sure. First, thanks for the invitation. Greatly appreciate it. Rob King, I'm the Chief Operating Officer for FHI Clinical. I've been here for a couple of years now. FHI Clinical is actually only about 3.5 years old. Wow. It actually spun out of FHI 360. FHI 360 is a large research organization that focuses on improving the lives of individuals around the world in low resource settings. Mm-hmm. FHI 360 has been around for about 50 years, and they've spun out three CROs so far. We're the third CRO to spin out from FHI 360.
Wow.
The first CRO spun out in the 1980s. It was called CRI and eventually became Clinical Trials Research. It was the first publicly traded CRO in the US. And then the second CRO was spun out in the mid-1990s. It was called PharmaLink FHI, and it was the first CRO focused exclusively on electronic data capture. And then in 2019, FHI 360 spun out FHI Clinical, which is a CRO focused on infectious disease, and particularly infectious disease for individuals in low resource settings. So I like to think that FHI 360 has been a trendsetter in the CRO business for many decades.
When you say low resource settings, Rob, what do you mean by that specifically?
So we're focused on parts of the world where there is poor health care, poor living conditions. So as you can imagine, we're focused in places like sub-Saharan Africa. We're focused in the Far East, places like Indonesia, Bangladesh. So we like to say that we do research, but we try and leave a place better than when we came. We just recently did work in Mongolia, and they're running their first phase 3 trial in Mongolia.
Wow. No, very, I guess, close to my heart then. So developing nations is where you're active, which takes me back to my former recruiting life, where I was recruiting expat engineers to go and build roads, bridges, infrastructure over in these nations. So it's I guess it feels rewarding when you're doing work in such countries, doesn't it? Just because you know that they haven't got the setup that what we do in the Western world.
Yeah, it's definitely a passion, not only for me, but for most people that work at FHI. I had the opportunity to visit Liberia recently. Mm-hmm. We have about 300 staff in Liberia that Wow. do clinical research. It's probably one of the largest research networks in Africa. And it's amazing the difference that you can make by providing some very basic health care and some technology, and you know, the people in country, they do the rest.
It's a great point you make, Rob. I've also been working in sub-Saharan Africa on some studies over the last couple of years. And as you say, I think that I'm not going to use the term Western medicine, but certainly the technology that we take for granted in the US, UK, Europe is something that is a step behind, isn't it? And alongside that, I think the implementation of good clinical practice and various other regulations that we take for granted, again, in the developed world, is something that is somewhere behind in those localities, isn't it? Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, everybody thinks that the U.S. is so far ahead, or Western Europe, but, you know, they really don't cover clinical research very well in the medical universities. And particularly when you get these low resource areas, clinical research is hardly covered at all. So the fact that we can go in and train investigators, train study coordinators, data management, bio staff, there are biostatistics staff all around the world, and give them those opportunities, it really makes a difference.
Wow. Well, it's. I mean, you've explained your passion, and look, it's clear to see why that is, Rob. But I know when I was reading your profile prior to jumping on to record with you, you know, I noticed, look, you're an industry veteran. So look, as we always do on the show, look, tell us about your background. I mean, we're probably rolling back the years a little bit here. I don't want to date you too much, but when did you get into the industry, and you know, how was that?
Well, like most people in the industry, I kind of fell into it by accident. Again, at university, no one mentioned clinical research. There were very few courses at the university on it. I actually started out in state and federal law enforcement, particularly focused on the psychology of hostage situations and terrorism. And this was pre 9/11 for those in the U.S. And I actually ended up in state law enforcement, focused on drugs, prostitution, gambling. And in a training exercise, I messed up my knee. And so they invited me to seek employment elsewhere because I couldn't run anymore.
Right.
You can't have a drug enforcement agent that can't run.
So I love that. So eloquently put, Rob, and very polite way of saying that.
Agreed. So I ended up at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The head of the Department of Epidemiology had just completed a large study with drug enforcement agents. And for some reason, he decided that a former drug enforcement agent would make a great project manager. That was not the case. But he thought it was. And that's how I got into the industry.
Wow, interesting. So law enforcement's loss is clinical research's gain, by the sounds of it on this one. So look, how did life look back then when you first got into the industry? So how did you start out? How did you start rising through the ranks? Because I from your profile, I see that you've held senior level positions at some fairly well-known CROs, many of them based out of, you know, Research Triangle Park. How did the progression come about?
Sure. So while I was at UNC Chapel Hill, I was in a meeting one day with a group of individuals from FHI. And as they were asking the head of our Department of Epidemiology questions, he would simply turn to me and I would answer the question. It was my job to know everything. Mm-hmm. And so after that meeting, I'm walking down the hallway, and the president and CEO of the CRO at that time, Al Siemens, said, "Would you like to come work for me?" And so that got me my first position in the CRO environment. Mm. And this was about the time that ICH-GCP was rolling out. No one quite understood it or knew how to apply it. Mm-hmm. But because of my law enforcement background, I knew how to read regulations and apply them. And so I made myself an expert in ICH-GCP and went around telling other people how to do their jobs.
So just to fill in the blanks here then, because look, this is, you know, something I have a lot of debates about. So I'm running a recruitment business by trade. The transferable skills from that law enforcement training and expertise that you had, what was it about that allowed you to read these regulations and tell people what they needed to be doing and how? Because it's an incredible skill set to have in any industry, but how did it transfer specifically in research?
Well, you know, any of us that have spent time reading regulations know that they're dry and boring, and sometimes they're very hard to interpret. So knowing that, you know, the first thing you do is you basically make yourself an expert. So when someone brings up the topic, you can refer to, well, ICH GCP 5.0 says this. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that you know where the information is located makes you an expert. And then the fact, because some of the regulations are a bit nebulous, giving your opinion, people automatically assume that you must be the expert because you have an opinion on it.
Yeah,
I made a lot of money in that time frame telling people my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So was I right? Probably not, but no one else was willing to speak up. So I think the thing I took away from law enforcement is you have to have an inflated sense of confidence, meaning that you'll just jump in with both feet, and if you're wrong, you're wrong. But in most cases, you end up helping somebody.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Go on, Adam.
As you were talking about that, Rob, I pulled up the book right next to my desk, which is the MHRA Great Guide on Good Clinical Practice. Exactly. And this is effectively, as you described, you know, it describes what we see and what we apply in good clinical practice. And whether you're auditing a company or you're being audited or you're writing SOPs or speaking to those SOPs, there is a principle that we're following all the time, isn't there? And again, whether it's FDA or MHRA or EMA, it's all the same flavor. That's the point. It's a rule book. It's a guide by which we run clinical research. And clearly you're very good at interpreting that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, everybody always says we do it because it's industry standard. So I always like to say, well, give me the citation or the regulatory citation of where that industry standard originates from, and then we'll talk about it.
So you pull people up on that now, Rob, do you?
Yeah.
Would you be able to point them out if they tried to bluff you and said something, and you would you be able to put them in their place still? Or,
well, I spent 16 years as a quality assurance auditor, so I sort of know when someone's bluffing, because again, I know the regulations pretty well. Mm-hmm. But I also know the mistakes that I made as a QA auditor.
Yeah.
It's easy to criticize others. We do that all the time, but it's really hard to actually do the work. And so I keep that in mind, that those individuals that are doing the work have a much tougher job than those of us who come behind and criticize them. Mm-hmm. I keep that in mind all the time.
Sure. Wow. So look, how have things, you know, how did they progress from there? How have they changed to now? So is it a few years since you've been with FHI Clinical? Talk us through that transition period to where you are now, and kind of those stepping stones in between.
So FHI Clinical in 2019 got their start without me. So mm-hmm. The first year, it spun out of FHI 360 with a core group of individuals. There was about 20 individuals at that time, and they were starting up. Basically, it was a startup CRO.
Yeah.
And so I knew the chairman of the board. I also knew the CEO, at that president and CEO. And I felt like I had some value to add. So I joined them about a year after they got started. Mm-hmm. Because this was my third CRO with FHI Clinical, I felt like they were going to go through all the things that the two previous CROs, which I had also been with, had gone through. So it's like a show that you've already seen. You already know the ending, and you know the plot, and you know all the actors. And mm-hmm. so actually, I thought the job would be pretty darn easy, because it was just wash, rinse, and repeat all over again.
Yeah. So look, what I mean, for, you know, my benefit and kind of the audience's benefit, what are the, you know, I typically say to I guess CEOs, when I approach them as a recruiter, that people typically fall into one of three camps when it comes to struggles with their hiring and growth plans. What are the typical problems that CROs face, and that the previous spin-offs from FHI had also been perhaps subject to, that you thought, okay, this is where I'm going to come in. I'm going to outline the problems before you even encounter them, and this is what we're going to do when that comes up. What are the common challenges?
Well, the most obvious one that everybody in the industry can relate to is that there's a lack of qualified resources around the world for clinical research. Mm-hmm. Adam probably knows this. There's very few biostatisticians, and everybody's fighting for that small pool of qualified biostatisticians. So if you go back to the very first CRO that FHI spun out, which was Clinical Research International, again became Clinical Trials Research, they had to hire a bunch of CRAs or monitors. At that time, no one quite knew what a CRA or a monitor was supposed to do. Again, ICH hadn't even come out yet, but they knew that they needed people to travel and visit investigational sites.
Mm-hmm.
So they hired flight attendants and they taught them the science. And these are people that were used to traveling, did not mind being on the road. They were okay with the lifestyle.
Rob, and, is that serious? Is that
on,
is
true that story?
No way.
Yeah. So
I mean, I've heard of some CRAs getting some grief. I did not know that that's how it all kicked off.
That's how it started. The very first CRAs came out of the labs because they needed people that understood the science. But with CRI, they took a different tack, which was let's have people who understand the lifestyle will teach them the science. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was very, very successful at the time. So applying that same philosophy today, and particularly in under-resourced areas of the world, when we're trying to develop CRAs, we may hire physicians, whether it's in Kenya or Malawi or Mozambique, and we'll train them on the clinical research part. They already have the underlying medical training. Mm-hmm. And as you know, we get paid fairly decently in this industry. Their lifestyle instantly goes up because as clinical research professionals, they make two or three times what they would make as a physician.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. I mean, that number is amazing. But my question around that, Rob, though, having worked alongside clinicians, are they not overqualified? You know, in other words, medically qualified people are, to my mind, far too qualified to be doing a CRA job where they're kind of doing their source data verification and going to sites. But I guess the protocol interpretation and maybe the training to sites is obviously, you know, what they're very good at. But I'm just curious.
Well, two things. When you look at GCP, it says the role of a CRA or a monitor is to provide oversight for the trial. And so if you're going into an investigational site and you're providing oversight and guidance to that physician, you want it to be someone that they can speak on the same level, they understand the science the same, and they have some type of clinical background. They can relate to one another. And so I think that's pretty important. And then the other part is we tend to think of clinical research as all-encompassing, but it's actually a collection of hundreds of therapeutic specialties. So whether you're doing cardiology or respiratory or infectious disease, and even in oncology, there are different types of cancers. So people don't want a CRA that understands oncology. They want a CRA that understands non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and particularly has worked in some type of unit for the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. And really understand the disease. So again, having physicians or very experienced nurses really plays into providing the best oversight for these physicians that are participating in clinical research for the first time or the 100th time.
Wow. Interesting model, very interesting model. I mean, what has that thrown up any different types of challenges that this is perhaps me with my agency recruiter hat on? Has that thrown up different challenges? Because typically when I speak to people, you know, it's sometimes hard enough to find those with the right attitudes, outlook to match with the existing team. And then when you throw in relevant industry experience, particularly as we're going as niches, you know, oncology, but a certain indication in oncology, like those people are sometimes like a needle in a haystack, and often that's why where people come to me. So has that thrown up any different types of challenges? Because look, the idea is amazing if you can find the people.
So we have done ourselves a disservice as an industry. Somewhere along the line, someone decided that a CRA had to have a minimum of 2 years of experience. Otherwise, they wouldn't use them. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of caught on across the industry. I think I've heard that 1,000 times. And my question is always, well, if you're not going to allow them the experience, where are they going to get that 2 years that you want? So I actually went back into the university for about 7 years and lectured on clinical research, trying to develop an influx of interested individuals that would go into clinical research. And so I taught at the graduate level, master's and PhD level students, because I figured that they would be most likely to be accepted by the industry. But I'm also a big believer that there are multiple individuals out there that perhaps don't have an advanced degree that would make a great CRA or a great data manager or whatever. Mm. And as the industry as a whole, we have to find these people, we have to train them and get them to work. Otherwise, as an industry, we're going to suffer. We're currently short probably 5,000 investigators right now, if you look at all the trials that are ongoing. And the last time I checked, we had a shortage of 14,000 CRAs in the U.S. Where are these people going to come from? And mm-hmm. we as an industry have to invest in education and training.
Absolutely. So how is, I guess, everything going? So when you started, I'm just trying to get my head around. So it was 20 people ish when you joined, and that was after about a year. What's the current headcount for the business now, Rob?
We're about 435 individuals globally now. Uh-huh. We have a large workforce in Western Africa. And so we've had pretty tremendous growth over the last few years. We expect that growth pattern to continue, but that's not unusual for small CROs. You tend to grow fairly quickly, and then you hit sort of a plateau right around 700 to 1,000 individuals. Mm-hmm. You hit that plateau for a little while, and then you jump up, and you go from 1,000 up to 2,500. And that's a fairly typical growth pattern for CROs.
Sure. Explain to me why is there that cap at that sort of 700 to 1,000 mark or whatever it might be? Why do you think that there's that plateau at that point for most CROs? Is this something you experienced with the predecessors of FHI Clinical?
Absolutely. Right. Again, it's wash, rinse, and repeat. Mm-hmm. You've seen it before. You can recognize it again. There's two things that sort of go into that. First, as a startup CRO, a lot of the larger pharma or biotechs tend not to work with the smaller CROs. So you're dealing with smaller projects, smaller clients in a lot of cases. Mm. So, and then the second thing is, as companies mature, they refine their passion or their mission. And in a lot of cases, they decide they sort of figure out what areas they really need to focus on and become really good at. Mm-hmm. Everybody sort of starts out as a generalist when you're starting a company. Yeah. But to really mature, you have to become a specialist in some area. Mm-hmm. And that's what causes that plateau of staff. As you sort of specialize, you become well-known, you're going to get more and more business, which allows you to grow.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And at what point, so I guess when you joined, probably shortly afterwards, we would have been hit by COVID, right?
Yeah.
Which I guess it impacted all of us, but particularly across, you know, developing countries, you know, they were not as well to, or as fast to get on with vaccinations, et cetera, as what a lot of the Western world were. So how did that impact you as a business? And I guess perhaps you as an individual, as the, you know, the chief operations officer, there was probably a lot of questions, just like when you were back at law enforcement, et cetera, a lot of heads turning your way and asking questions, Rob. So how did you juggle that? What was the game plan there?
So it's a horrible thing to say, but COVID was the best thing to happen to us as an organization. A couple of reasons for that. We knew that we planned to be a virtual organization, and COVID sort of forced us to move into a virtual environment much quicker than we had planned. Mm-hmm. And that helped us out in a number of ways. Secondly, since we focused in infectious disease, COVID fell right into our sweet spot, mm-hmm. and we were able to jump in and help not only pharma and biotech, but also different governments around the world and wow. their COVID plans. So for us, it was actually a very exciting time. It couldn't have come at a better time for a young startup organization that focuses on pandemics and outbreaks. Mm. One of the reasons why FHI Clinical spun out of FHI 360 was because of the Ebola outbreak that happened right. in Liberia. Mm-hmm. And so we flew a group of individuals into Liberia and helped provide CRO services for the Ebola treatment that was ongoing at that time. And from that, they realized they had a model that we could then apply to future pandemics and outbreaks and other infectious disease. And wow. COVID verified that model for us.
It sounds very similar to the experience I had also, funnily enough, Rob, because some years ago, I was working for a German biotech company that also did very well out of Ebola. And that was how they pivoted. Almost word for word, as your experience was, is how it's been for them as well. Because that virtual piece, I think overlaying the technology and the science and the therapeutic area and excellence coalesces around a success story, doesn't it? There's not many Exactly. people who succeed in this environment, but certainly, you know, to the points that you've made with regards to, you know, the vaccine and immunology piece, having the right people in the right place with the right technologies, it sounds like, you know, you were very fortunate.
Yeah, it's true. We say that when others run away, we run towards. Mm. And so when there's an outbreak or a pandemic, we won't be on the front lines.
So in a strange or odd way then, Rob, that's perhaps been the biggest achievement of the business, certainly since you joined, is because of COVID. Is that a fair enough statement?
Yeah, I think so. Again, you know, COVID killed a lot of people. Mm. It's still ongoing today, even though the news media doesn't cover it as much. And, you know, it was our testing ground, and I think we were successful.
Mm. No, it certainly sounds like it. And, you know, the growth that you've achieved has been, I mean, in my eyes, fairly phenomenal. What other successes have there been aside from that? Because I don't want to just focus on the COVID piece, because it sounds, as I said, I've been approached by, I think, two or three people who have suggested to get yourself on as a business, that is. So look, talk to me about some of the other work and other achievements and successes that you've had over the last couple of years as a business.
So we've been able to work with the U.S. government on a number of initiatives, some of which I can share and some of which I cannot. But particularly our work in Liberia and on the Prevail Network has been very successful. We got notice that they had granted us the Prevail Network, and we had to hire 230 people in a couple of months during the pandemic. While travel to Liberia was restricted. And so we were able to hire those individuals and get the network in place without ever visiting the country a single time. Obviously,
so were those 200 all over in Liberia, was it? So 200 people in Liberia-ish?
They were primarily located in the Monrovia area. There's five hospitals and a laboratory as part of that network. So physicians, nurses, security engineers, anything you could think of in running a hospital or a clinical research site, we helped put that in place.
Incredible stuff. And look, I guess it sounds like there's been one hell of a journey since you joined FHI as a business. How has this been for yourself, Rob? Because as much as, you know, it's kind of, you said a couple of times, you know, it's, you know, been there, done it, you know, it's rinse, repeat. But with the COVID element, it's, you know, perhaps thrown a little bit of lighter fluid onto that fire. So what have you learned about yourself and your management style? Has it changed, or, you know, has it been consistent?
I'm a little softer than I used to be. I used to be a hard individual. And I think as I've gotten older, I've come to realize that it's, you know, helping others achieve their dreams that are important to me. The thing I like about FHI is that it is a nonprofit. It is focused on making the lives of others better. And FHI Clinical Week exists solely for the benefit of the FHI Foundation. All the proceeds and profits we make will make their way back into the foundation, and they'll go off and do great things around the world. You know, I spent some time in between jobs getting a nonprofit management degree from Duke University. And I knew that I wanted to go into a nonprofit environment and make a difference. But because of my commercial skills, I knew that I'd have to do something to help generate funds for somebody else who could go off and do great things with that money. So joining FHI Clinical, which is a for-profit CRO that then funnels its proceeds back into a nonprofit that does spectacular work around the world, that seemed just the right fit.
So that's the FHI Foundation, you said. So what type of work is it? Is it specific to research that they do, or is it all sorts of charitable work?
So the FHI Foundation is there to support the work for FHI 360 that needs to be funded. If you think about a nonprofit, you know, they get grants from other individuals to go off and do great things. Sometimes you can't find a grant for something. You have a really great idea, but nobody wants to fund it. So the foundation exists to be able to funnel funds into FHI 360 for these wonderful ideas that nobody is funding at the moment. If we go back to the HIV crisis that occurred in Africa, you might remember, at least in the US, it was the Bush administration that helped push for that funding for the antiretroviral therapies in Africa. Mm-hmm. It was FHI 360, though, that piloted the use of antiretrovirals in Africa and proved that they would work, which then allowed both the US and the UK and other, you know, government agencies around the world to then fund that. That initial funding by the foundation came partly from the sale of the first CRO that they had spun out. So it's always not thinking about today. It's what can we do today to generate funds for what we need to do tomorrow?
Wow. Okay, look, I can see where the vision is and where the mission is and where the passion comes from at your end, and it all kind of makes sense given your background and the commercial aspects that you can bring to the table. So look, what's next for you in the business in terms of, you know, future plans? You know, you're not quite at that 700 mark, right, where it starts to plateau just yet. So is there plans for future expansion, different countries? What's in the pipeline, Rob, if you can share some of that with us?
We just rolled out a campaign about our focus on Africa as part of the World Vaccine Conference in Europe. So we've made it a corporate mission to be the top CRO in sub-Saharan Africa. Right now, from purely a staffing count, we're probably the third largest full-service CRO in Africa. But it's our aim and goal that we will be the number one CRO operating in Africa within a few years. That's our first goal. And then our second goal is to expand into other areas, including the Far East, into places again like Indonesia or Bangladesh. And we want to go where nobody else will go. Mm-hmm. And we want to basically make it an attractive place so that others will also come. We want to be a path setter. We'll go where everybody else is scared to go. We'll create the environment for others to then join us and hopefully drive healthcare around the world.
Wow. Sounds like one hell of a mission, doesn't it, Adam?
It's absolutely incredible the way you describe that, Rob. Having worked in this industry like you for many years, I think your intentions as a company are wonderful. But also, I actually think that there's plenty of people who are willing to join you on that journey, because we're all in this, I think, for other people, you know, for the benefit of the patients and our loved ones around us who benefit from the medications and the pharmaceutical products that we are responsible for creating in clinical research. So, I mean, I had no idea this is where the conversation would go today. It's totally blown my mind, to be quite frank. And the way that you've described it is really so uplifting that many times, you know, CROs get a really bad rap, don't they? They get a bad rap because, excuse me, they're all about profit and they're not about the patient, and they're certainly not about leaving something better than you found it. And it sounds like that's absolutely pivotal to what FHI are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I would sort of leave with you is that Africa accounts for about 18% of the world's population. There's actually very little clinical research done there, but the most genetic diversity in the world occurs on the African continent. So if you really want to test your investigational drugs or biologics, Africa is an ideal choice because of the genetic diversity. You're more likely to figure out whether your product works in a broader patient population in Africa than you were anywhere else in the world.
And it's not many people that talk to that point, actually, because they only see color. That's the other thing. Diversity is genetically diverse, isn't it? And that's the point. Right. I've worked on, you know, bridging studies where you compare white Caucasians with native Japanese, and that's considered to be, you know, a diverse population. But the diversity that you describe, again, is more diverse than just through color, isn't it? And I think that's an amazing point as well.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm just so pleased that I got the recommendations to reach out to you folks. I owe a few thank yous to a few people. And the fact that you've said yes to come on the show, Rob, is a bit of a bonus because, you seem to have a good sense of humour. You know what you're talking about. All been very good fun. But look, before we let you go, we always close the show with a quick fire questions round. So it'd be good to pick that veteran brain of yours in research, just for a few tips for those that are perhaps looking to either follow in your footsteps or trying to follow, yeah, what your, you know, the general mission. So look, I'll kick off with, you know, what would you say is the one piece of advice that you'd give to your younger self?
Network more. It's important to network with others, not because you want to build a broad network of contacts, but simply that there's a lot of really smart people out there, and you never know when you want to need some advice or guidance from someone. And the broader your network, the more likely that you'll be able to find the answers that you need.
True story.
Great point. And also recognize that there's always smarter people out there than you. And that's what Absolutely. I've learned. Surround yourself with smart people and you look great, right?
Exactly.
Make sure you've got a good network of smart people around you. I think it's brilliant advice. Our listeners always like to hear what resources or books that you're reading at the moment. What is on your bookshelf at the moment, Rob?
Well, I'd like to respond to that question by saying, don't read anything related to your own industry. Read about other industries. Some of the best ideas I've ever come across from my industry came from other industries. I'll give you an example. I was reading a book about a company that made paper, and they were frustrated with their clients. They didn't know how to order paper. So they did a boot camp where they brought all their clients in and taught them all about paper. The weight of the paper, the color you can choose, how you can order it. And their sales went up, you know, 200%. So years later, I did a EDC boot camp. We brought all our clients in. We taught them how to do electronic data capture. And our sales went up more than 200%. So you can always learn something from another industry.
That's brilliant.
I like that. I like that a lot. I guess, yeah, sometimes it's just copying what successful people do, and by default, you will in turn be successful. So absolutely. Very good advice. And look, speaking of success, it's clear that your model of hiring is a little bit unique to me. However, you know, I like the fact of, yeah, perhaps getting people, you know, the flight attendant thing, just, yeah, that's incredible. But look, what would you say are the top three qualities that you value most when personally hiring people, Rob, building a team?
I like diversity. I like people with different backgrounds, people that can bring different perspectives. So I tend not to hire people like me. I already have one of me. I need somebody different than me. The second thing is I'm looking for people that have passion. Maybe they have a passion to move up through the organization, or they have a passion for, you know, healthcare. Yeah. Anyone that comes across it is not passionate about something, I tend not to hire them. And then the third piece I would be is rotating leadership is really important. I only hire people that I can see serving in some type of leadership role. Whenever we have teams, I like the idea that no one person leads the team from day to day, that leadership shifts. So we need people who can be leaders in their own areas.
I like it. I like it a lot, Rob. I like it a lot.
Great advice, honestly. It's brilliant. When you're not working, what's your favorite thing outside of work, Rob?
Besides doing what my wife tells me to do, I do like the hype. Yeah. The saying is true, you know, happy partner, happy life. So I make sure that my partner is very happy.
Cool. Well, I guess we always close the show with a more deep and meaningful question. So look, what is it that your number one golden rule for both life and business, when it's not just trying to keep the wife happy and partner?
It would probably be dream for others. While I do have my own personal dreams, I actually get more satisfaction thinking of ways to help others achieve their dreams. So if I think about the staff that work with me, the colleagues I interact with, I daydream for them. What can I do to help them achieve their dreams? Mm-hmm. Because I found that if the people around me are successful, as Adam was saying, I'll be successful.
I like it. Rob, you seem to talk a lot of sense and, just very straightforward in the way you do things, which is, yeah, always a preference for me. So, look, for anyone else who is in my network who has been dying to learn more about FHI and what the organisation is doing, perhaps not just at FHI clinical level, but on a wider scale, what is the best way to do that research, reach out to the company, find out more?
So obviously you can always reach out through our website, but I would offer that we're all active on LinkedIn, we're active on Twitter. If you see an FHI clinical or even FHI 360 person that holds a similar role or a role that you're interested in, don't hesitate to reach out to them directly. We are a very passionate, empathetic, and friendly bunch. So there's no roadblocks to reaching out to FHI clinical staff. We'll talk to everybody.
You could be busy, Rob. You could be busy. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Look, we'll get you all tagged up when it goes live. But look, thanks once again for being on the Huxley Morton podcast.
Thank you.